Bloody Elbow presents the MMA Vivisection, the show that gives you a comprehensive breakdown and expert analysis of all the fights happening on this weekend's UFC card. Here are your hosts, Zane Simon and Connor Rebush.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush. We're here once again talking about UFC 268 going down this week in Las Vegas. No, in New York. In Madison Square Garden,
I get. How could you mix it up, Zane?
I know. I've spent like a year and a half saying Las Vegas, Nevada.
Only 95% of the cards are in, well, not quite Las Vegas.
Yeah, in Paradise City.
Paradise or Enterprise, which are the same, different towns?
I don't know. It's all just suburbs.
They all sound sort of cities in like the BioShock universe. You know, that's right. Like old objectivist, early 20th century industrialist city names.
Yeah, unquestionably.
Mm-hmm. Eden, Nevada. You know. Nevada. Sorry.
Nevada.
They get mad about that. They insist on it being Nevada.
Hey, well, we just talked about Billy Quarantillo and, you know,
yeah,
his apparent supposed Italianness.
You live just north of what many on this side of the country call Oregon.
Oregon. Mm. That's right. We are talking about the prelims here for UFC 268, quality, pretty deep and fun prelim card of UFC action.
Yeah.
Not the biggest name card that the UFC's ever put together, but it packed with interesting action fights all up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's definitely going to be a violent prelim card. I think I can say that unashamedly. The lowest chance for violence on this whole prelim card is Phil Haas versus Chris Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not yet entirely confident that Phil Haas has the collected confidence to stick out a 3-round grind.
No, usually something terrible happens.
Yeah. So
even in his most impressive fights are marked by his ability to actually like get past the terrible thing that happens.
Yeah. So this should be a pretty fun night of action. Prelims should be awesome. Main card will pretty much unquestionably be fascinating and violent. Like there are too many fights on that main card that have no other option but violence for me to think that it will not be a fun night of fights.
Oh yeah. Main card is dynamite for sure. And I have no complaints about the prelims. They're fine.
No. Yeah. And we'll jump straight into our featured prelim, the UFC debut of noted Adesanya slayer, Alex, and kickboxing champion, Alex Pereira. I've learned my damn lesson. Against Andres Mikalaitis. And this should, I mean, it'll be a violent fight no matter what. Mikalaitis, I suppose it is, or is it? Yeah. Mikalaitis doesn't really tend to have other options than violence. He's not a clean striker or clean wrestler or clean grappler. So whatever he's doing tends to have to be wild and painful to somebody involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I don't know. It's like as forgiving an action fight, I think, as they could give somebody like Pereira.
Yeah, I think so. It's to me, it's the perfect intro fight for him to see if he can do this. Because if I had to go out right now with a prediction for Alex Pereira, and this is giving away my fight prediction as well, it's that he will probably go out and he will clean up two or three fights in the UFC middleweight division based solely on his power striking prowess.
Mm-hmm.
And then he will run into somebody not even necessarily that people are totally enthused about, but, you know, like an Edmund Shabazian or a Marvin Vittori or somebody else out there similarly in the division, and they will just blow him out of the water, and that'll be the end of this whole thing.
What makes you think that? Because I kind of have a similar vibe, but why does it feel like Pereira is less well-suited for MMA than Adesanya?
Well, Adesanya, to his credit, made MMA a priority almost all the way through his kickboxing career.
Yeah.
Like, he had 3 or 4 years where he was kickboxing before he started MMA, but then he regularly took MMA fights just while he was kickboxing.
It's true.
And he clearly worked on it the whole time, and he developed it the whole time. And then when he was ready to make the jump over, even though his wrestling still seemed raw, it was clear, like, it's been clear in the time since, that he was ready to build all the pieces in. Like, the investment clearly had a goal to it that he was ready to piece together. For somebody like Pereira, like, he MMA was something he tried a decade ago and then was like, or 5 years ago, and then was like, okay, no, this isn't working out.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go back to kickboxing. And
he also hasn't been, he's got some tremendous striking skills and a lot of power.
Yep.
But he also wasn't the kind of kickboxer Adesanya was.
No.
You can look at their fight. And it's like Adesanya basically beating his ass for like 2.5 rounds and then getting caught with that left hook, which is Pereira's specialty.
Yep. And you can, you know, you can go actually look at Pereira's fight with Thomas Powell. And what you'll see is actually a fairly even fight.
Yeah.
On the feet for a couple of minutes before Powell just gets caught with a monster left hook that knocks him out cold.
Yep.
And like, that just, all of this to me has, you know, he's 34 now. This has a very Gokhan Saki feel to it.
That is exactly what I was just going to say.
Like, it's
he was a guy who allowed chaos as a kickboxer. I don't think he's going to have the wherewithal to prevent the chaos of MMA. And, you know, he's still going to get wins the same way he did. Yeah. There's still, it remains, just as it was for Adesanya, a very open question of how easy it will be for certain people to outgrapple him. I think there's still a chance that somebody like Mikhailidis could come in there and make him look pretty bad with just dogging.
Mikhailidis will shoot takedowns. He shot in on, what's his name? The former Cage Warriors champ, Modestus Bukauskas. Got him elbowed in the head a bunch, but, like, there's nothing to say that Pereira is going to have the wherewithal to do that if Mikhailidis shoots in on his hips and just pulls his hips out from under him.
Yeah, and he may, in fact, be safer, because I think Pereira has to focus more on defending the grappling than doing damage in the clinches.
Yeah.
So, you know, Adesanya himself, despite having that experience, had a dreadful grappling performance in his UFC debut. Just scraped by the skin of his teeth. So, but, you know, at the end of the day, Mikhailidis is a brawler.
Yeah.
He
principally likes to strike, and he just wades in swinging hammers to do it.
Yeah, he's going to offer his chin up, and you just, there's only so long you can do that against Pereira before he times that left hook. So I'm going to pick him.
Yep, that's it. Like, I, you know, like I said, I think that there's a good chance that Pereira wins 2 or 3 fights in the UFC, just being a power punching technical, structured kickboxer with a good idea of what he wants to do. He can fight dudes like Mikhailidis. He can fight a dude like, you know, Marc-Andre Barrio or Dalcha Lungiambula or something like that. And just fight guys that also otherwise generally like to strike and don't do it that well, and win a few fights. And the UFC's gonna, he's 34. He's not gonna want to wait around. The UFC almost certainly spent money on him. This is not gonna be like some 13-13 deal.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to wait around. There's a reason he's a featured prelim here.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get him into a fight with Adesanya. So if he wins two or three fights, they're going to start sticking him in against top 10 or top 15 opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just probably going to get smoked. And
yeah.
Then he'll, like, you know, I mean, Gokansaki is back kickboxing now.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible idea because he's like 40. But that whole thing, his whole time in MMA lasted all the way up to Khalil Roundtree. And then it was just like, okay, wait, this is a terrible idea.
Yep, we'll see.
Yeah,
who knows, he might also get I think the UFC is more openly willing than ever to sort of cultivate a path to the title for certain kinds of fighters.
Sure.
So, you know, he might also get like a Brad Tavares.
Even still though, that's exactly what I'm talking about though, is like a Brad Tavares. I mean, just like a guy who might lose to this kind of fighter, but is just gonna, he's not gonna be prepared the way even Adesanya was for that fight. And it's
no, but there is close to coin flips where, yeah, where he at least has a kind of a power that, yeah, even Adesanya doesn't have. It doesn't have to be as consistently impressive a performance for him to knock people out. So he might get there. I'd be happy to see him in an MMA fight with Adesanya. Why not?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's a dream goal. I just don't think it's ever going to get close to happening.
Yeah. There seems too many ways to screw it up.
Yeah. MMA in general, for these kinds of fighters making these kinds of moves,
mm-hmm,
it tends to be terribly unkind.
Mm-hmm.
We just saw with Clarissa Shields, you know, like she just lost a decision to the worst fighter they could scrape up to face her.
Yeah, I heard people saying, like, why would they give Clarissa Shields a grappler? Somebody who's going to out-grapple her. And people are like, that she is a striker. It's just MMA strikers kind of know how to grapple.
Yeah, they don't actually know how to strike that well. They do know how to grapple fundamentally.
Yeah.
And
you can just kind of stumble into a win as an MMA fighter because it's not boxing or kickboxing. It's a different sport.
Yeah, it is a sport that is much more open to chaos. And there's a reason that, you know, there's a reason boxers don't spend their time thinking, oh, I'm going to go try to make an MMA run.
Yeah.
Like women have to do it because women's boxing is a farce that doesn't pay anything.
Right.
But.
And there's women boxers already, because of that, tend to have broader experience in other combat sports. Like Holly Holm was a kickboxer,
yep,
as well. She competed in both.
Well, she was trained by Jackson,
or by an Mike MMA Winklejohn, coach, right?
And, which was not necessarily the best thing for her boxing career, but made her. You know, she'd been doing MMA the whole time,
right? Basically, Lucia Riker. You know, great female boxer, was also a great female kickboxer.
Mm-hmm.
Famously had a fight with a man. That was great. So like, I think if there's ever like a male boxer who was going to come over, even like Adesanya, it's important to remember like how rare what he's doing is.
Yeah. And it was with the dedication going back 5 or 6 years from him to be like, no, MMA is also a thing I'm going to do.
Yep. It's Lomachenko or nobody.
Yeah.
Lomachenko has wrestling experience. It's got to be somebody like that. Somebody who.
But just, even then, if you're Lomachenko.
Why would you?
Why would you? Like,
there's absolutely no pull to come to MMA.
Yeah, you look at me like, am I going to go like get beat up by Colby Covington? Is that what I want to do with my career for like half the money I can make in boxing?
Yeah. Well, he's way smaller than Colby. It would be more like, I don't know, I'd be fighting bantamweights.
Yeah, so you have to go fight Peter Yan.
That sounds awesome.
It does, but
that sounds so sick. Yeah, but like it would have to be somebody who, like Adesanya, just sort of has like an interest in tinkering with other combat sports to begin with, and yeah. also somebody who has the financial incentive to think that MMA might be a move up.
Yeah, kickboxers do have some of that.
It's yes, kickboxers don't.
No, boxers do not. I would also say too, training out of Glover Teixeira's gym, like. It's really cool that Glover makes that work, but like who are the fighters that come out of Glover Teixeira's camp? You know,
I guess if you're a 185er, like having Glover as a training partner,
yeah, it's not a bad like training partner to have, but as a whole MMA readiness thing, like,
yeah,
I have trepidation.
Mm-hmm.
Still, well, yeah, I gotta pick him against Michalidis just because, yeah. You know, if me being worried about having Glover Teixeira as your base camp coach is a concern, certainly fighting out of Athens, Greece is a much bigger concern.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know what, you know. And what the EFL Martial Arts Academy? I have no reason to think that they're.
Does that E stand for Hellenikos or something like the Greek word for Greece?
Probably.
Elas.
I don't know. It just says yeah. Let me see if I can. I'll pull it up on. Oh wait, no, I have Tapology already open. I don't have to type anything in. Michalidis. Let's see if Topology actually has it. They're so bad about having actual fight camps.
Man, his head coach has such a cool name. Dimitris Papakonstantinou.
I mean, even there, it just says EFL.
Yeah, it stands for nothing. They're just like, so MMA has lots of acronyms. We got to have letters.
Yeah, I can't. I'm trying. I'm finding the Facebook page now.
I don't know why you're going on this wild goose.
I'm interested now, but yeah, I don't know. All right.
All prompted by me trying in vain to show off that I know a Greek word.
A Greek word, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Okay. let's jump over to our odds. Odds on the fight. Pereira is the favorite, opened at -150, dropped down to -255. That's where he is. Andreas Michalidis opened at +130, jumped up to +203, currently +202. So, mm-hmm. yeah, wide. That is wide on Pereira. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to think that he's going to even... There's no good reason to think he's going to win even one UFC fight, honestly, at this stage. His MMA... career to date is what, 3-1?
Mm-hmm.
And the best opponent on that is 4-4, Thomas Powell.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he did get a win over 6-0 Marcus Vinicius way back in his jungle fight, short-lived jungle fight career. Vinicius being a generally okay regional vet back there, but
mm-hmm.
nonetheless, one win over a 4-4 guy in 6 years should not inspire any confidence that the Pereira is going to be any kind of fighter in the UFC.
No, it could be, you know.
I'm just saying, if I were a gambler, I would be fading him.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
All right, that, and I'm not a gambler, so when I say that, please take
say that, Zane. It's a gambler's sport now. You have to pretend. Is.
It's true. That's right. I bet fat stacks of cash that I make through my high-paying bloody elbow job. All right. That brings us to a lightweight bout. Ally Aquinta, Bobby Green. And I love this fight. I love that the UFC made it. I love that it's Ally Aquinta taking it. And obviously, any chance to see Bobby Green fight is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a time, not that long ago, I would have just been like, oh, Ally Aquinta.
Mm-hmm.
He'll win. This is his fight. He will push forward. He will wrestle. He will throw some hard punches. He will put enough of a pace on Bobby Green that he will win the fight. I don't know if Ally Aquinta's that guy anymore.
No. Well, even then, I'm not sure if that's what you exactly what you want to do to beat Bobby Green unless you're really, really good.
Well, it was a point where Ally Aquinta was really, really good.
Yeah. But you know, like Thiago Moises like really carefully picked his spots to come after Bobby Green.
Mm-hmm.
And then otherwise just like made Bobby Green lead, which is Bobby Green doesn't like doing.
Yep. That said, Aquinta might make Bobby Green lead as well. Just for the simple fact that he doesn't like fighting that much anymore, maybe.
Yeah. Doesn't seem to.
Doesn't seem to like the UFC that much.
Mm-hmm.
Has been out of fighting for a couple of years now, and every time he walks away for even a moment, I tend to start thinking that he's just retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he recently even talked about like being in a pretty low place with the sport lately. And kind of having to pull, I think it was like a constant string of injuries too, and having to pull himself back together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was even sort of, maybe I'm thinking of the wrong person. I don't think I am though, that he was saying that he's not really ever going to be like fully healthy. He's just had to find ways to be able to keep training at this point.
That, I mean, there's nothing to prove to me that he didn't say that. That seems like a pretty common thing. Wizened MMA fighters have to say.
Yep. And so that makes this, I don't know. This makes it a really interesting fight, because Bobby Green is capable of winning or losing any fight that you put in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
He fights a very judges unfriendly style. He does not work behind. He has a good jab.
Got a great jab.
He's got a great jab. He does not work behind it nearly as consistently as he could.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, he likes to have people come forward into him where he can mm-hmm. throw slick counters and he can move and dodge and things like that. The crux of what has really gone wrong for Ally Aquinta lately has been almost entirely just a realization from opponents that he has no game outside the pocket, and if you can stick him outside the pocket, he can't find a way in.
He's front foot heavy, he's plodding, his face becomes a target the moment he gets close to his own range.
Yep. And he does not have any tools to deal with a jab or mm-hmm. low kicks. But Bobby Green won't offer those things that consistently to him.
Yeah.
Bobby Green will let Aquinta, or Aquinta, I don't know. I'm just trade back and forth saying both over and over.
It's Aquinta.
Aquinta. He'll let Aquinta wade in and have his fight, and he will try to best Aquinta in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he might not. Like, he might outland Aquinta 2-1 and still lose, because that's what happens to Bobby Green.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm gonna pick him here just because I don't know what's up with Aquinta right now, but there's not the surface level of this fight to me does not feel like the exact challenge that Aquinta loses. and it does not feel like the exact challenge that Bobby Green loses.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it a tough fight to call. Because, you know, there's a day when Alec Quinta beat Jorge Masvidal. You can argue that he shouldn't have. But Masvidal can present a lot of the same kind of problems as Bobby Green.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like Bobby Green is, I mean, I Quinta is at a low point, I think.
Yeah.
And I think Bobby Green is at a high point. Like, I think this may, in fact, be his prime.
Yeah. I mean, Bobby Green is, he's a young veteran. So
absolutely. He's been a veteran the whole time.
Yep.
He's had a defense first style the entire time, has, especially considering how insane and violent some of his fights have been, has really not taken that much damage.
Mm-hmm.
And is like, he's just a technician first and foremost. So he has just deepened his technical ability and become more and more sort of defensively immune. The longer his career has gone on, it's like he's exactly the kind of guy to have a late prime.
Yeah.
That being said, he's still Bobby Green. He's only grown more into being Bobby Green.
Yeah.
Where there is still this fundamental thing where, like, there's always this tipping point in Bobby Green fights. When the opponent comes after him, they're like, oh, he's not doing enough. I'm going to barnstorm him. And whether they are like as sort of limited as Lando Venata,
mm-hmm.
or as incredibly adaptive as Rafael Fiziev, there comes a point where you just go after Bobby Green too much, and he has to respond.
Mm-hmm.
You awake the true Bobby Green. And then, but even in there, you still have fights like the Trinaldo fight or the Moises fight where it's just like he can't get going.
Yeah.
So this is interesting.
He'll awake the true Bobby Green and he'll do something cool for a minute. And then he'll be like, yeah, I did something cool. I'll just go back to slipping and making you look bad. And I'll feel like I'm winning. And the judges are like, yeah, but, you know, they landed one of the 20 strikes that they threw and it looked like it hurt and you just slipped a lot. And sure, you landed 5 strikes on the counter, but we didn't see any of them. So they win that round.
Or you can have the best moment of the entire fight, like he did against Fiziev in the third round when it's too late.
Yeah.
He is awesome. I love Bobby Green so much. I honestly, like, I think his fight with Fiziev might have been my favorite of the year. Even including fights like Volkanovski Ortega and like Oliveira Chandler, like there's just an energy when Bobby Green is on against an opponent who won't let him rest that is unmatched. Just the amount of fun he's having in these fights is awesome. It's infectious.
If you are a real fight nerd who is into the fights for the technique of the fight and for the seeing fighters try and assert themselves in fights.
Yeah.
Not just the drama of the fight, or, you know, there are a lot of people who are nerdy around this sport in ways that are fundamentally disconnected from a lot of the actual action of it, I would say.
Sure.
But if you're that kind of nerd, Bobby Green is always, always fun to watch. 100%. He is one of the most entertaining fighters to watch, even when he has a fight like the one he did against Trinaldo, because the dynamic of watching fighter, like, there is no fighter who creates a more complicated dynamic around asserting their fight in a fight. There's mm-hmm. no fighter who has a more complicated relationship with the action of a fight than yes. Bobby Green.
Yeah. And who just, he won't change, you know, nope. He only just gets better at being the exact flawed fighter he's always been.
There are mercurial, like John Jones is a mercurial personality.
Yeah.
It is rare to actually see somebody that is a mercurial fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby Green is a mercurial fighter.
Yeah.
Like things are all the way on or they're all the way off. And it doesn't, like, there can be a mix in between where he's just sliding between different points of engagement in a fight that, you know, any 1 minute could be totally different from the next in terms of how engaged Bobby Green is.
Yeah. So I think my first read on this fight was like, oh, Bobby Green deserves this. You know, Ally Quinta, like I said, he's at a low point. He seems pretty disinterested in fighting. Green just had one of the most awesome close defeats I've ever seen. In his last fight, he just is always Bobby Green. My guy, he deserves this. Seems kind of easy. But then he's Bobby Green.
Yeah. So,
even the fact that Ally Quinta seems less effective, less able to pull the trigger than at any other point in his career, could just make this fight all that much closer.
Yeah, like, is Bobby Green going to jab and kick Quinta apart? Probably not.
He could.
He could, but he probably won't.
It would be right there for him, and he's got the skills to do it, but yeah.
He probably won't. And if he's not, Ally Quinta, like I said, there's a point at Ally Quinta's career. We don't know really how far removed he is from it, because Donald Cerrone and Dan Hooker certainly took what he offered and just used it against him relentlessly.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a point in Ally Quinta's career where he was a very good fighter, where he was a very capable pressure fighter who consistently created fight-changing offense on the front foot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like Bobby Green is incapable of losing to that guy.
No.
But I'm picking Bobby Green here.
Same. You got to pick him. You just can't. I really don't know where Ally Quinta is at as a fighter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the very least, Bobby Green is unchanging and eternal.
Yep.
And he does, you know, like, if for once in his life he fights like kind of a smart fight, he does have all the tools to do exactly what Cerrone and Hooker did to Ally Quinta. Mm-hmm.
I also got to wonder just a little about that Sarah Longo camp as a camp that creates like the change they create in fighters. Because like, obviously a lot of their fighters, they have the right mentality. They have the right confidence. The surprising grit, you know, guy like Chris Weidman is, like, he's still out there throwing himself into fights where you're like, oh, no, that's a terrible idea. But then you also got to think, did the adjustments in Chris Weidman ever make him better? Did the adjustments he made over the years? Because he did adjust, like, he did try to change things. It's a camp that is not afraid to try and change things. Aljamain Sterling has made big adjustments over his career.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a camp that can create those changes. I do wonder if, like, you've got a fighter like Ally Quinta who might be settling into some fatal flaws. Like, is he going to come out changed? And if he is, are those changes going to be anything that actually creates something constructive?
No, I mean, most of the changes usually seem to amount to, like, just being more aggressive.
Yeah.
A camp like the time that Chris Weidman moved away from that, the pressure, which was just like increasingly him like suiciding himself into the opponent, was because he switched to Mark Henry as his striking coach. Whereas like Sterling's approach to Piotr Jan, all out aggression. So even if that is, if they do make Ally Quinta turn that kind of corner again, I think that's arguably better for Bobby Green.
Might be. Yeah.
He's again, he's really good when people just spend three rounds trying to come after him.
It's true.
He'll still let entire minutes of the fight slide by, but it's when he gets his most impressive round winning moments.
Green opened at -130, dropped to -155, is currently down at -177. Ally Quinta opened at +110, jumped up to +135, and is currently up at +145.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That brings us to middleweight bout. Phil Haas, Chris Curtis.
What to make of this one?
Yeah, this is a tough one, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's a well-booked fight as a debut for Chris Curtis. I think that this is, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not a softball booking, But he's also in his 30s and has been fighting for more than a decade, so he doesn't need a softball booking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very winnable fight.
Mm-hmm. But also, like, I don't know. I just still don't know what to make of Phil Hawes.
Yeah, I still don't know what to make of Phil Hawes. Well, we know kind of what to make of him, which is that he is a supreme athletic talent who has not turned yet into a confident fighter, and he might be making those moves now.
Sure.
But
he had a better comeback from that surprising moment that happens in every fight where he gets almost finished than ever before in his last fight. But he still went up to that line. He still had that moment.
And it's worth noting that it's been 7 years now. So you do kind of wonder how long is it going to take to turn this corner?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Or will he ever?
Yeah. Like he's 32. He's not a young prospect anymore. Probably the fighter we saw against Daukaus, that might be a sign this is the complete him. This is as close to having everything click for Phil Hawes as it's ever going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still a supreme athlete, so that's not undangerous. It's not bad. But it does still seem fatally flawed, potentially.
Yeah. He's still a better athlete than Chris Curtis.
Sure. I mean, he's at his peak, Phil Hawes, you know, when he came into the sport, he was a better athlete than almost anybody.
Right. He's got huge power. He's super fast. He's very physically strong.
Yeah.
It has frequently been an out for him, even when he doesn't really have any kind of technical wrestling or grappling advantage, that he can just pin people, as he did again and again to Nassourdine Imavov. Mm-hmm. To sort of lock them out of the fight. It doesn't seem unlikely he could do that to Chris Curtis. Doesn't seem unlikely he could knock Chris Curtis out or hurt him badly either. It's happened before. Happened in Curtis's last PFL fight. I think it was his last one.
His last was a rematch against Magomedov.
Oh, so it was before
Magomed Karamov. Yeah, but it's Ray Cooper.
Yeah.
In the second to last. Yeah.
Yeah, Ray Cooper, he had a pretty close fight with him, several exchanges, and Cooper just came up with the better timed counter to end their last exchange, knocked him out cold. Curtis is like, I think he's a more confident striker than the likes of Kyle Daukaus.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But he's a less fluid one.
He is a true MMA archetype, which is the slick, somewhat slick, low output counter fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, he is confident, he is capable, he has the form and technique, and he absolutely does not press a fight on anyone.
Yeah. He'll get into distance, you know, right on the edge of range consistently. And he's like calm enough and he looks like an experienced fighter in that when you like, he can look past that first throwaway strike or feint.
Mm-hmm.
So he will just sit there like watching the opponent as they throw their jab and then try to react either with defense or with his counters to the second and third layers of that exchange. But he gets himself out of position on a regular basis going for those counters.
Mm-hmm.
He can't necessarily, I think this is just like an athletic limitation, past that point. He will often just like bail out, backing straight out of the pocket and get caught retreating. And sometimes people are also just quick enough that like while he's sitting there waiting to react, they just catch him by surprise because he's right there on the edge of range waiting to come up with the right defensive answer.
Or as has often happened in I think a lot of his losses, they can just, if he's not throwing, they can just rush him and pin him on the cage and then start taking him down and out wrestling him.
So I think it's a fight where Phil Hawes will almost certainly get himself into trouble.
Yeah.
At some point, Curtis is a competent puncher. He hits hard enough. He's got timing and can counter opponents consistently. But there are enough holes in Curtis's game, enough ways for Halls to either just take the fight out of the fight and control him, or surprise him with speed and power. It's just another Phil Halls fight, basically. That's how I see it. Yeah. So I guess I'll pick Phil Halls because he's always got that out. And I don't know that I trust Curtis to finish him if Halls can just reach out and grab onto him and survive like he usually does. So I'll take Phil Halls for being a crazy athlete as usual. Yeah.
I will say, though, I mean, part of his huge amount of experience and his low output is Curtis is still very present and dangerous well into fights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he won by corner stoppage in round 4 of his first fight out of the PFL.
Yep.
And he's won, beat UFC vet Kyle Stewart via TKO in round 3 after that.
It's very similar to Halls' fight with, like, Imovov. Like, here's a guy who will still be there, still looking to time counters, and maybe just won't press the action enough to make that a win. But yeah, he's super consistent and very experienced and doesn't get shaken by having dropped rounds. You know,
he's a finished product.
Yeah.
Yep. He's a vet. He's been around forever. He knows his game. He stays within it. And if you can just stay safe and take the fight to him over and over again, you can beat him. But if you don't stay safe, he can finish you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting fight. I think I'm going to take a flyer on Curtis.
Okay.
The big mark of Haas's recent success is that he's fighting and beating people less experienced than him.
That's true.
And that he can make people panic with his own work.
That's true.
And I don't think he can do that here. So I'm going to take the flyer on Chris Curtis here. I think he can stay safe and stay controlled enough to be there in round 3 and then hurt him. Haas is a big favorite, opened at minus 350, jumped all the way up to minus 323, is currently down at minus 347. Curtis opened at plus 275, got all the way down to plus 248, but is currently back up at plus 265. All right, that brings us to a middleweight bout, Edmund Shahbazyan. Another middleweight bout, I should say. This card's actually got a few of them. Edmund Shahbazyan, Nasruddin Imovov. And, you know, I like this booking more than I thought I would. Just because, A, I think that the UFC rushed Shahbazyan hard their first time when he got to the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
To his own detriment. And B, I think Imovov, he's getting a little of that same treatment, frankly. But he put together a great performance against Ian Heinisch. And this feels like, you know, I mean, if both guys are going to be in the same position, then them fighting each other right now seems like a good, you know, a good control for that kind of over-eager booking from the promotion. Mm-hmm. That said, I really am still much more a fan of what Edmund Shahbazyan does in the cage than I am of what Nasruddin Imovov does in the cage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is really hard for me not to look at that Heinisch win that Imovov had and be like, wow, Ian Heinisch looks terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Ian Heinisch looks like something broke in him.
Yeah.
Somewhere along his MMA journey. And I don't know where it happened. I don't know how it happened. But he is not the confident, bull forward, am I throwing an overhand or a double leg? You have to decide which and then scramble with me fighter that he was when he ran into Derek Brunson.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I don't know what. I don't know where he broke along the way, because TKOing Gerald Meerschaert the way he did doesn't tell us anything. And then otherwise he's run into a series of dudes Omari Akhmadov, Derek Brunson, and Kelvin Gastelum that he just could not out-wrestle and then could not out-strike.
Yeah.
Imabov should not have been that guy, it doesn't feel like. But by the time he reached that fight, he did not have any of the confidence that he was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, to Shabazzian's credit, he may not still have a deep technical game to back up his fast starts and his layer of good power offense. And I don't know that he'll ever get one fighting out of Glendale. But he still appeared, at least, you know, into the Jack Hermanson fight, to have the exact same willingness and understanding of how he wins fights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, he starts hot. He throws a good 1-2. He's got a very snappy jab. He's got a lot of speed, and he's got a lot of power on the rear hand behind it. And he puts that together with good pressure. And if he starts feeling pressure himself, then things start to fall apart, especially if there's a lot of wrestling behind it. But Imabov is not that technical a wrestler, and his pressure really comes in fits and starts. He's more of a, much more even of a jump in, jump out kind of fighter.
Yeah.
And more fragile on, more prone to getting pressured on the back foot and getting clipped on the back foot when he has to be the one backing up. So I think a fast start from Shabazzian can do him a lot of credit here, and I'm not sure that Imabov has the style to really change this fight on him at any point.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to look at, like, Imabov's fight with Halls.
Yeah.
And not see him having a chance in the third round. He's
very consistent.
He's very tough and arguably too consistent in that he, like, for all that he got that chance against Halls, he couldn't turn it into a finish. Because he's like, all right, now I've got you hurt. It's almost like the wrong side of like being a Rashid Magomedov kind of fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now I've got you hurt. Now I just need you to make one more fatal mistake. And the opponent's like, I'm hurt. I'm not going to do anything. and he's like, okay. I guess I'll wait you out.
Yeah.
It was very difficult for him to lead and just make the finish happen, even when it was right there on the table against Halls.
Yeah. And what breaks Shabazzian tends to be constant pressure, and especially wrestling pressure, where
exactly. It can't be where what happened to Imabov against Halls was that he, like, the reason he couldn't press the attack is that anytime he would try to put more than two strikes out there, he would just get grabbed onto and didn't have an answer.
Yeah.
So I will say that the another difference here between this and the Halls fight is that Shabazzian doesn't just, like, get hurt every time in a fight. He gets tired.
It's so true. Yeah.
Maybe that means he can't just go out there and willingly grab onto Imabov and shut him out of the fight the way Halls did. Like, no matter what happens to Phil Halls, he's going to be strong and fresh enough to grab onto you and hold you still.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's the case for Shabazzian. And it's also the case that now that Shabazzian has experienced that first failure of his bullying style, there's maybe that seed planted where each time he feels that turning point happening, he's going to have his, like, PTSD flare up like self-fulfilling prophecy style gas himself out all over again.
I'd have to see it happen first before I trust it. But it's true. It could.
Yeah. I'm just saying there's it's very hard not to see at least like a 40% chance that Imabov gets that kind of moment that he got against Halls. Shabazzian is a two-round fighter at best when he's having it all his way, which he probably will early, but he defeats himself to an extent.
Yeah. He runs out of ideas in the cage, and he runs out of ideas that much faster if his opponent can start wrestling him and beating him up.
Yeah. Yeah. And Imabov is a sharp counterpuncher, and he's, as you said, very, very consistent.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm gonna, you know, I'll take Imavov just because it feels more exciting. I still don't really trust Shabazzian. I feel that he's gonna get hurt, and if I'm right, then he just may not have the energy to preserve himself in those scary moments the way that Phil Hawes did.
Fair enough. Odds on the bout, Shabazzian is a very slight underdog here. Opened at -150, jumped up to +125, currently down at -101. Imavov opened at +130, dropped to -152, and is currently back up at -121. So odds are starting to swing back in Shabazzian's favor, but I'm a little surprised. I mean, I know he's lost two straight, but like, we're talking Jack Hermanson and Derek Brunson.
Yeah.
Beating Brad Tavares is a lot more impressive even than beating Ian Heinisch in the kind of shape Ian Heinisch was in when mm-hmm. Imavov beat him.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, Imavov has losses to Phil Haas and Michael Michalski and Ayadi Majdedin that are, you know, much worse than anything Shabazzian's got on his record to date.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I get that Shabazzian was the golden child of a moment who is not anymore, but I'm a little surprised that Imavov is favored even still.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree.
All right. That brings us to a welterweight bout. Ian Garry, Jordan Williams, and I'm not... this is you, I suppose. So yeah.
What were you going to say?
I'm not going to pick Jordan Williams to win a whole lot of fights, especially not against skilled opposition. And I'm really not confident about him winning fights at welterweight.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I was going to start with too. I just, Jordan Williams is not, he does stand as one of the ultimate examples at the moment of how truly random MMA is.
Mm-hmm.
Guy's got a win over Gregor Rodriguez.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
who has now beaten a good prospect and a savvy vet in his first two UFC appointments.
Yeah, that is definitely it's testament to how random MMA is. It's also like Gregory Rodriguez fights with his chin way up in the air. And
yeah, but you look at those two fights.
Yeah, yeah,
the level of defense displayed, the way he deals with the adversity. Look at any Jordan Williams fight. You wouldn't be like, yeah, Williams's game is a mess.
It is. It is a mess.
I wouldn't even.
He is predict, a brawler.
Yeah, I would not predict that same result to happen again if they rematched at all.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, he almost got knocked out by Gregory Rodriguez at the start of that fight.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not going to pick him here. Ian Garry is like a slick technical boxer. Who's probably going to, rather than going in there and engaging with Williams, is probably just going to like outslick him and let him burn himself out and touch him with jabs and kicks from distance.
Yep. I have a few worries about Garry in that he's built the confidence of a fighter not used to having people hang with him in spots, both offensively and defensively. Notably, he tends to leave the pocket with his hands down and circle away with that confidence of like, oh, I'm too far away for you to touch me thing that got, you know, it makes me think of Trevin Giles.
Mm-hmm.
And then also he's had several grappling exchanges, especially like in his last fight in Cage Warriors, where like he just needlessly stuck himself in a spot that he had to fight his way out of, and he was good enough to fight his way out of, but it's just like, this guy's got a knee bar that should never have happened, and you're having to fight it off just because you jumped on him and assumed that you could just outgrapple him from any position once you took an aggressive stance.
Mm-hmm.
But those are things that, like, Jordan Williams, I don't expect Jordan Williams to, like, grapple him or outgrapple him. And Jordan Williams could swing on him big enough to catch him fading out of the pocket if he's not paying attention. But Jordan Williams will also very clearly tell you that he is coming for you with a swing that's a mile wide.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're really not paying attention, that's your own fault.
Yeah. Nor is Williams like the kind of tough you need to be as a brawler. to just you can interrupt him and stop his flow over and over again. Yeah. You can run him into your jab. Like, he's so defensively vulnerable, so hittable. And doesn't, like, he just doesn't flow through combination. So it's not like the kind of thing where you stand in front of him and jab at him, he's going to keep coming with punches 3 and 4. It's like, oh, he has to, like, take a stumble back on his heels and, like, blink his eyes clear and then try to reset up all over again.
Yeah. No, there's not enough balance in there to just eat shots and keep coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason we picked Mickey Gall to beat him, and
yeah,
it also helps to hear that Ian Garry is huge at welterweight.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that they noted on the broadcast, and I've had to try to pay more attention to with debuting prospects, because I often just kind of overlook how big they might be. I either assume that their opponent is just massively undersized for what, you know, the regional scene, or that they are you know, otherwise normal. But they mentioned it on broadcast here. He's 6'3" as a welterweight. So, you know, that will negate the only other factor that might have been in Jordan Williams' favor as a former middleweight. But the only reason Williams was a middleweight is because he's diabetic and didn't want to cut weight. And so, as I say, I will always have extra questions for Williams at welterweight.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just got to go Ian Garry all the way. Odds on the bout. Garry is a heavy favorite. Opened at minus 290, currently down at minus 376. Williams opened at plus 235, currently plus 286. Not too surprising. That brings us to a heavyweight bout. John Volante, Chris Barnett. I guess they cut Roque Martinez, so this is the next best thing that we can get to Chris Barnett versus Roque Martinez. I'm still pissed about that. This we had a Megaton championship fight right there.
This is good, though. This is like the only other one to give Chris Barnett. Like, I feel like what you have to do as to pit him against as a guy who has just always been fat is to now just give him all the light heavyweights who got fat and went up to heavyweight.
Yeah, we got to do John Volante. He wins this fight. Then we do, name that Volante just fought?
I'm forgetting his name as well.
Damn it, I just forgot it. Jake Collier.
Collier, of course.
Yeah, then we do Jake Collier.
And Jake then, Cudlier, I believe, as I nicknamed him last time.
Jake Cudlier. And then if he wins that, we do Alir Latifi. And then if he wins that, then we do OFP.
Yes. Who hopefully by that time will be at a healthy 320 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll really start filling out that heavyweight frame.
Yeah. And you can lose any of these fights at any point and get these next fights too along the way. I'm not...
Keep it going.
Yeah. Just keep it going.
Why do you have Chris Barnett here if not to see this like little chubby man do crazy athletic things like twice a fight?
Yeah, and I mean, this is what pisses me off about them cutting Roque Martinez, is like, why do you hire these guys if you're going to cut them?
It's like, oh, it turns out you're not good. No shit.
Yeah.
you hired them.
Yeah. You knew going in. These are for circus fights to fill out the bottom of cards, and they should always be there. You hire this person, you should be... This should be like, you know, the toy clapping monkey that no matter how far you throw it away in a horror movie or destroy it or whatever, it's just always you turn around and it's right there on the shelf again.
Yeah.
Like the moment you let this into your house, it never goes away.
it's like at the core, it's a core problem in the UFC that like, This is what you get when you have a president who like unironically like wakes up in the morning and pumps himself up by listening to Godsmack's I Stand Alone. Like
he has Godsmack on his alarm Yeah. He goes off and somehow being woken by that, by like blaring first thing in the morning for 20 years, he's still not tired of it. And it still pumps him up.
Not at all. And yet it's completely unironic. If somebody sniggers at that, hearing that music, it makes him mad.
His wife has like a whole separate house she sleeps in now because of this.
She's got tired of this just sweat-soaked affliction bed sheets that he just, as a like 70-year-old man, thinks are just the coolest thing ever. This is the problem. If you can't embrace the silliness of MMA, so you bring in these complete goofball fighters who are just like, yeah, this is the stupid division. Let stupid stuff happen. And then you get mad at them and cut them when they don't like turn out to be good.
Yeah.
They're not good. They're heavyweight.
Yeah. They're carnival grade heavyweights.
Yes. Just let it be a carnival. But no one can have a silly walkout. Nobody can make a joke out of the sport. It has to be very serious and very adult, even though it is self-evidently one of the stupidest, most immature entertainment products that isn't pro wrestling.
Yep.
So, but you know what? The matchmakers seem to get it more than Dana does, because look at this.
Yeah. No, I mean, they've always clearly been a part of. At least Joe Silva was always clearly just a little bit of a carny.
Yeah. They'll do the silly nickname versus nickname fights and the hilarious like physique contrast fights. And here we just get two sloppy fat dudes.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that's the only reason this fight was made.
Yeah. So that said, I'm picking a Huggy Bear.
Yeah. He wears it better.
Yep.
I'm with you. That's really the reason too. He is very naturally and comfortably this little chubby guy.
Yeah.
And John Volante is just like sweatier and easier to exhaust than ever before, while also like seeming to have taken several technical steps back as a fighter.
Yeah. John Volante looked like he drank himself to this division. You know?
Yeah.
Barnett. I mean, he may have eaten himself to this division, but if he did, he did it like 14, you know?
Yeah, he started early. It's like the difference between Adesanya and Alex Pereira.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, one guy has been dipping his, not he didn't dip his toes. One dude jumped headfirst into these waters many, many moons ago.
I thought you were going to say one guy has been dipping his like nachos into.
Yeah, He's been dipping
his cheese sauce covered nachos into butter.
John Volante is like, oh, maybe I'll try being a big fat guy. No, sorry, too late.
Yeah.
Experience wins. This is a classic case of why you always pick the OG.
Yep.
Exactly. Chris Barnett is the OG fat man.
Yep. Oh, I think that's enough technical. I think that's all the breakdown I need to have for it.
I love that this fight is on the card. You need a bit of everything, and this is like the slathered like buttercream frosting on top of the cake.
This is the tachos of the meal, the tater tot nachos of the meal.
Yeah, you have like a delicious steak. You have fries so fancy they call them palm frites.
Yeah, you've got a tiramisu or like, you know, this really, you know, beautiful dessert that comes out that's got like raspberry vinegar, like a little raspberry drizzle on top.
All of that coming after an appetizer of taquitos.
Yes.
Hot dogs right off the gas station roller.
Yes. Absolutely. Barnett opened at plus 130, dropped to minus 135, is currently at plus 103. People are betting against him here, which means they're betting on John Volante, and that's worrying.
Yeah.
John Volante opened at minus 150, jumped up to plus 121. Very reasonable. Currently back down at minus 125. I mean, throw your money away. I'm not going to stop you, but please. Betting on John Volante in 2021.
Don't do it.
No. All right. That brings us to a light heavyweight bout. Dustin Jacoby, John Allen. And if I love John Volante versus Chris Barnett and understand it thoroughly, or think that Phil Haas versus Chris Curtis is like perfect matchmaking, for Chris Curtis's debut.
Mm-hmm.
And love Ally Quinta versus Bobby Green and think that that is a great fight.
Mm-hmm.
This fight makes no goddamn sense.
I don't dislike it because I mean,
I'll watch Dustin Jacoby win. Sure.
Right. I like Dustin Jacoby. I've become quite invested in his second UFC career.
Yeah. But why are you booking this fight?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get it either. This feels more like what we usually get on the fight night cards.
Yeah.
Like this so is just, oh, okay. these guys weren't booked.
Yep. Dustin Jacoby wanted to fight, and we were like, oh, we got this guy is willing to take this fight against you on this date.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I don't know what the trajectory is for John Allen anyway. Like,
oh, in fact, it was a better booked fight to start. It was John Allen versus Alexa Kamer, which makes perfect sense. And then Kamer got injured, and Jacoby wanted a payday. So here we are.
Okay. Yeah. It becomes a much more difficult fight for John Allen.
Yeah. Infinitely more.
Yeah, who's kind of a mess as a striker.
Yeah, he's got that wade forward Brazilian Muay Thai style that's not really Muay Thai. It's just like we have to call it Brazilian Muay Thai now because it's just like,
yeah,
what a bunch of dudes who are into what a culture entirely based on beach toughness thinks Muay Thai is.
Yeah. Yeah, the school of beach vigor.
Yeah.
You know, he like got frequently outstruck by Roman Dolidze at every point where Dolidze wasn't making like a just loathsome facial expression and out grappling him.
Yeah.
God, I hate Roman Dolidze. Have I said that before?
Yeah, you've said it many times. I like Roman Dolidze purely based off of your hatred at this point.
That's fine. It's literally the only reason I can imagine anyone liking him is hatred
despite of me. You.
Yeah, that's it. It's the only good reason anyone's ever come up with. At least I understand spiting me.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's done it your whole life.
Yeah. I have a lot of practice with being spited. So,
parents onward.
Yeah, pretty much. And Dustin Jacoby is like good at striking. He's got a great jab. He can be a little inconsistent. He can allow opponents into the fight, sort of Bobby Greenish in a way. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think he's just got some still grappling with not liking all of the parts of MMA that much still, and being like, God, I don't want to have to do anything other than strike. Don't make me.
Yeah. But even just in the striking, like, he can have this thing where like, you kind of have to force him to fight well.
Yeah. I think it's part of that though. I think it's part of that. Like, don't force me to do anything else. Damn it. And that just gets into his head even in striking.
Yeah.
It's just like, look, I just want to stand out at range and like kickbox with you. Come on. And it doesn't matter even if his opponents, that's all they're doing. He's still thinking about it.
Yeah. But just as a baseline of technical skill, he's just a far, far better striker than Allen.
Yeah.
He's got better footwork. He's got better technique on his individual strikes. He's got a lot of variety. Good low kicker, good jabber, decent good on the counter, fighter. Good clinch fighter. And the only thing that really troubles him is somebody who can continually press him with wrestling. As we saw against Iwan Kutalaba, he can do better and better at that as a fight goes on.
Mm-hmm. And he really came out and punished Darren Stewart for it away.
Yeah, he smashed Darren Stewart. And the flip side of that is that Allen is not really a dominant wrestler either. So
nope.
Yeah, it's Dustin Jacoby is the only man to pick in this fight.
Yeah. He saw Alexa Kamer get injured and was like, hey,
yeah,
this is good for me. I can get paid again this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, good for him. It seems like honestly a good career decision. Keep that confidence going up.
Stay
active.
And yeah, he must have taken this on somewhat slightly short notice. Let's see. Looks like he stepped in on. Oh, they actually. He stepped in on two days ago, Jacoby. But I'm also just going to assume that having been a kickboxer for quite a while and taking that kind of approach to fighting for a while that Jacoby's also just kind of ready.
It doesn't feel like the kind of thing he would do unless he was in shape.
Yeah, and I just, you know.
And Allen is a fighter you can figure out on the day.
Yeah, sports that aren't MMA, and well, that aren't boxing as well at a certain point, but aren't MMA, tend to have a much more like, no, you just stay ready and you just are prepared to take fights mm-hmm. style of being around the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that that's where Jacoby is. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't have any.
He is also a veteran. He's a veteran of both sports now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would just assume that Jacoby, no part of me thinks him on short notice is bad for him here.
No.
Jacoby opened at minus 250, is currently minus 340. Gamblers agree. John Alon opened at plus 210, is currently plus 263. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Melsik Bogdasarian against Bruno Souza. And on the flip side, I do not have a lot of faith in Bruno Souza coming in on short notice here against Melsik Bogdasarian. That seems like a bad move. I mean, he's getting his foot in the door of the UFC. I understand that. But given his fighting style, I do not think this ends well for him.
Mm-hmm.
You watch Bruno Souza on the regional scene, and he feels like a guy who is very much made to be a regional champ. Like, fighting, nothing I think has probably been better for Bruno Souza's career than the fact that he was able to run his way into an LFA title. Let's see, when did that happen even? Looks like he got there just in his last fight, actually. So he's gotten a bit lucky in his career to get there, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that the split decision over Kamuela Kirk and Elijah Johns are that luck. Because he's got a very long tenured karate style. It's pretty obvious. He's out of the Machida Academy, so
okay.
He's been doing karate for a long time. He looks like a dude who's been doing karate for a long time. That consistency of form and style is very clearly what's giving him wins, because he's a very comfortable fighter over many rounds. He can really stick to and be confident that even when he gets hurt badly, that he can return to a very centered technical base and fight out of that. But that technical base is still him standing tall and getting clubbed a lot,
mm-hmm.
especially early in fights. He is a fighter that has to fight back from the brink of defeat a lot and recenter himself and find room for himself back in the fight a lot. And like, Machida was kind of like, there's a reason it's called Machida, the Machida Academy, and that it's like Lyoto Machida Karate. Like, he and his brother, but especially him, like, they were masters of this form and this style. It is not an easy way to fight.
Yeah.
To sit there and lean. And even Machida at some point in his career tried getting away from it.
Yeah.
He became a volume kickboxer. And he reinvented his career at a certain stage away from this one-shot kill counterfighting. And I don't think that Souza is going to be able to do that. Like, this feels like being the training partner or student of a guy whose style suited them perfectly because they did it their whole lives and were masters of it, and trying to be a pale imitation of this. he feels more to me like the kind of fighters that come up under like Nick or Nate Diaz. And you're like, wow, yeah, trying on that style of fighting is not a good idea. Because Bogdasarian is just a power crushing kickboxer.
Right.
He starts really hot and he comes out really fast and he throws really hard. And being a guy who gets cracked early looking for single counters seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah. And also, you know, like, let's not forget, Lyoto made that style work at light heavyweight.
Yes.
Yeah. Where, like, you get a lot more limited games and guys that you can just flummox in one area. And does Bruno Souza have the peripheral elements of an MMA game that Lyoto Machida had? Because people also love to forget that, like, Machida frequently out grappled people.
Yeah.
It wasn't
surprisingly good wrestler.
Yeah, he was in fact a great wrestler. He had fantastic foot sweep and trip takedowns. He had solid top control, like even late into his career, like against, say, Gegard Mousasi. Like those were the grappling elements of his game would frequently be the thing that really like cinched the win. Yep. He seemed to have such a remarkably pure karate style for so long, but even before he went and worked with Cordero and started introducing more like aggression and more boxing, he was still a really pretty diverse fighter.
Yeah. Yeah. Santa Souza has some takedowns and stuff, but they appear to be pretty like fundamental, basic wrestling takedowns that aren't that deep or technical, but they're just sort of tempo changers.
Right.
And I don't trust that. Bogdasarian. He's just kind of a wild man, and he's a pretty technical one, and he throws really hard, and it's just a question, you know, he's very much cut out of that Giga Chikadze cloth, although probably a better natural athlete, and it's just a question of how much he can adapt while learning on the job, because he's got some great pure power kickboxing. And he can be taken out of his game and he can be exhausted and he can be drowned and stifled by people who just don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamentals of what he's working with there they're pretty likable. Like it's something that, you know, there's good reason to like what he's opening up with. Of course, he's currently apparently affiliated with Muay Thai America Gym. And otherwise fighting out of Glendale, and I have to imagine getting some significant time in Glendale. So the fundamental, oh wow, this is really good, can he add more to it over time? That may never happen.
it doesn't seem to be the specialty.
But like Shabazzian, I would still just say, like, being a powerful, fast starter with good technical fundamentals is probably going to carry him through some, you know, already got him a win over Colin Anglin in his debut, and I expected to get him another one here.
Yeah, if I trusted Souza a little more to come back with a late finish or something, if Bogdasarian does have that Shabazzian-esque tendency to sort of run out of ideas when he can't sort of just overwhelm someone out of the gate. But as you said, Souza just sort of like stays hittable. He does have a couple third round finishes.
Well, one of them's a DQ.
Ah, yes.
But I would say that Souza's great talent is his consistency with which he like, he will just return to, like, he has got a very calm, clear, fundamental belief in his style. So he will get clubbed early in a fight. You can see it, like, against Javier Garcia. Garcia came out and beat his ass, dropped him twice in the first round, hurt him immediately in the second round. And it is just Souza's ability to just go back, stand there, be collected, and be like, no, I'm going to walk in on you and like create exchanges where I can land a blitzing couple of counter shots over and over and over again, and I'm confident that, like, he can do it. But I don't think that people that hurt, you know, seeing him get hurt that badly early in fights at a low level does not give me any confidence of what somebody like Bogdasarian does to him coming out of the gate.
Yeah.
That's really it.
Yep, I agree.
So it's just, yeah, like I say, the thing, yeah, light heavyweight, Lyoto Machida being a lifelong student of that and having a deeper bag of tricks to draw on. Those are the kinds of things that, like, Lyoto Machida had a whole thing that he could build around that. Souza just, it's a little bit of a pale imitation at times. Even if he's still very fundamentally calm and collected around it. Bogdasarian is a big favorite here, opened at 185 and is down at minus 315 at this point. Souza opened at plus 160 and is currently up at plus 247. And that brings us to our opening bout, a flyweight fight, CJ Varaga or Vergara against Ode Osborne. And
it's a bit of a tricky one to suss out because Ode Osborne seems like a classic glass cannon. I think he's like, for example, he went out there and I thought had some really good moments early against Manel Kopp.
Yeah.
Stung him with some great counters. I mean, he's quick handed. He's got quick reflexes. He has a nice sense of distance, so he can sort of pressure and just use his footwork to stay on top of somebody, draw strikes out of them and counter them. And he did that like really patiently against another counterpuncher in Manel Kopp, and did have some really great moments early at Kopp's first few like exploratory strikes.
Yeah.
He's also just been like one shot KO'd twice. Since coming to the UFC.
Well, the Kelleher one was technically a sub, but still, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's definitely a fighter that is, he's excellent at bouncing in and out of distance and picking spots to burst in on opponents with dynamic offense. But when those are the kinds of exchanges you're creating, you're always leaving opportunities for you to be just countered just as dynamically. You know, it's a very live by the sword, die by the sword style of fighting that he promotes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know that CJ Vergara is like, he's like weirdly undynamic for a flyweight. Or at least he's not agile.
No.
He's a very rooted fighter. He seems just slow in general. Like the hands and strikes don't seem that quick by flyweight standards. Like I feel like Ode Osborne is once again gonna have a ton of early moments and might just be quick enough to just knock Vergara out early.
Yep.
Because like I said, Vergara will just sort of linger in range. He'll back straight up out of exchanges, doesn't have great defense to go with that lack of speed. But granted, against a relatively low level of competition, so far he has been tough and consistent.
Yeah. I mean, Vergara's got a style I really love, which is he's a combination pressure counterpuncher.
Yeah. And he finishes everyone he beats.
Yeah. He loves to walk you down. He's going to try to make little slips and small moves and come back with big, powerful counter shots in combination. It's a fun style. It's one of my favorite styles of fighting. It's just also insanely difficult and a very narrow, you know, it's we you see it out of Sun Yong Park, the Iron Turtle. He tried it against Gregory Rodriguez. You're like, oh, wow, you've got Gregory Rodriguez right there on the ropes. This is working great. And then a minute later, he's the one getting TKO'd standing.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to deliver these very minute defensive adjustments while throwing bombs in the pocket. And it is a very, very tough. It is equally as live by the sword, die by the sword is what Ode Osborne is doing, but on a very different footing.
I'm gonna pick him though, because I think he seems just a little less likely to die by the sword. I don't I think Ode Osborn has a fantastic first layer.
Yeah.
Or even the first two layers of an exchange. But I think it so far it looks like you can just kind of push past that. And while CJ Vergara may often take a while to get to those latter layers of exchanges, he will find his way there eventually. So I think pressuring Ode Osborn, giving him limited options, a guy who relies so much on his speed and surprise, and the guy who I know can be knocked out, I'm going to pick Vergara.
Yeah, I'm going to pick Ode Osborn. Mm-hmm. I just think Vergara is too slow. I think Osborn, this is a great fight for him to just stay way outside and just look for big bombing shots. Vergara, once again, this is like, you know, he got hurt like three times. In fact, that might have been confusing him a little bit with Bruno Sosa, although Bruno Sosa also got hurt several times by Javier Garcia. They both got hurt several times in the opening rounds. Like, Vergara did very nearly get KO'd by Jacob Silva in his last Fury FC fight before he got to the Contender Series, because he was just walking in on him over and over again, and Silva was way faster and just crushing him early in that fight. And yeah, it's a testament. He didn't get knocked out. But, you know, it's also like Jacob Silva's 8-6 and small. And not a big finisher. He's not a bad one, but not a big one. And Ode Osborn is a big flyweight and fast and powerful and does finish people in round one routinely. So I'm going to take him to get the round one finish here.
Yeah, he finished people in the first round and he gets finished in the first round, which is kind of my concern.
Yeah, but, you know, that win over Bruno Correa aside, Varaga is not a dude who finishes people in the first round.
Sure.
Which, you know, might also, it speaks to his toughness, but it also might just speak to the fact that Osborn, if they're going to go out and create a clash where one of them gets finished in the first round, Osborn might be the one who's dynamic enough to do it. Odds on the bout. Ode Osborn is the favorite. I'm a little surprised. Opened at minus 150, dropped to minus 160, currently down at minus 179. Vergara opened at plus 130, is currently up at plus 149.
Yeah, where's the Contender Series bump?
Yeah, no kidding.
The hell?
All right. On that note, you can find me on Twitter at these same time. You can find Connor on Twitter at Boxing Bush. You can find both of us over at Bloody Elbow. As always, the MMA Viv section is brought to you by Combat Wombat, makers of fine art prints featuring famous fights and fighters. That's all the work of Chris Rini. You can find his stuff over at chrisrini.com, chrisrini.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We're also on Apple TV, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents, and you'll get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The Best of the Come On Now MMA Podcast, Brooklyn's Corner, the MMA Vivisection, the Level Change Podcast, Show Money, the Sixth Round Post Fight Show, Sixth Round Retro, the MMA Depressed Us, and Radio Style Play-by-Play for every UFC pay-per-view. You can also follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow and on Facebook at facebook.com/Bloody Elbow Blog, and of course on BloodyElbow.com.